finally, I could ask you about how you see the role of the Friends of Kibakusha, including, you know, members like yourself in this larger project. So you mentioned earlier that you have to work with the CAPS and then you have to contact with people and there's a planning committee. But how do you see the importance or significance here of the Friends of Kibakusha in this entire picture?
Well, you know, one of the things that we participate in this project is because we want to continue to support the survivors in a way that fills their needs, and at the same time work with others who perhaps feel the same way. And the whole idea, the bigger picture of this is the whole humanitarian aspect of it. And I think that we're all in agreement with. All the people that we, you know, from the medical society to the hospital, the medical center, all the volunteers, you know, that's everyone's view is that, the humanitarian aspect of it. And the caring, you know, providing an actual service that is needed. And I think that's what keeps everybody going. And I think that's what everyone sees as the benefit of working on this project together. Because without everyone working on it together, it wouldn't be as successful as it has been over the years. And also, I think we've developed enough relationships and friendships so that it becomes very personal. So when it becomes very personal, you meet the kibakusha themselves, you have the interaction with them, you meet the medical team members, and also the other supporting organizations and all the different individuals, it becomes a very personal project too. And that makes it even more meaningful. And I think Barry, it was so sweet of him, Barry Lawler, he's the medical director at the medical health clinic, and he was saying that this is really, this is our mission. This is why we're here. This is the purpose of what we do, to serve others, and especially those in need. And this is probably one of the more important projects that we participate in. And they've been involved since 1995.
It's been a long time.
I really appreciated him saying that.
Like you said, that the same project really involves different kinds of people from all kinds of different backgrounds. And my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that Friends of Kibakusha are just that. So they are Friends of Kibakusha, not necessarily Kibakusha themselves. And then there are CABS, who is the organization of the survivors themselves. And then there are medical teams, both from American and Japanese side. What do you see as a challenges of working with people who are from, you know, different backgrounds? And I'm sure sometimes there will be different kinds of priorities or different kinds of interests involved in that. How do you see those challenges in this work?
Well, I think one of the things that, you know, especially with the medical visit, it's something that is, you know, a defined period of time. So preparing for it, working on it, and then afterwards doing the follow-up for it is, you know, already predetermined. So you already know how much time possibly it's going to take. And it's not, and it's, even though it's ongoing, it's something that, you, you know, your time and your commitment is only for a short period. So I think that makes it a lot more easier to involve more people. And everybody knows their role. Everybody has a role, and they know what they're supposed to be to do. And so I think that makes it so much easier. It's clearly defined. And I think when it's clearly defined, then you know, well, whether you have the time or you don't have the time, you can actually say beforehand. And you can either commit yourself or not. And I think that's what I think makes everything work. And I think for those people who, like some of the volunteers and organizations, they've been involved for years. It's also because the people who have been involved are still involved, you know, from the very beginning. Well, some people have changed, but basically it's the same people. It's been that consistency over time. And I think for like the volunteers and the survivors, when they see each other, it's like a mini reunion, you know.
Right, sure. That's the impression I got as well.
And then for the survivors, it's really important for them to see other survivors. And it's a time for them to just kind of, you know, see that, gee, you're still around, you know.
Nice to see you.
And I think for the volunteers themselves too, they've come to know each other, and then also they've come to know the survivors. So it's something that I think every 2 years we have a chance to do that, to reconnect.
Yeah, so that's something that you can look forward to, even though it's a lot of, you know, work to do. But I see what you mean when you said that, you know, there is a suddenly clearly defined roles for everybody, so everybody knows what they expect.
They know what to expect, and they know what they're going to be doing, and what their participation is. And so that's what I think has made it easier. And so when it comes to kind of adjusting in case something were to happen that's kind of unusual or whatever.
Like you in examination.
It's okay.
Yeah, so miscommunication might take place, but because people are used to doing it, that can be taken care of as well. Now let me completely sort of switch the gear here and probably ask you a question about yourself a little bit, because you are obviously one of the main organizers of this effort, and I really like to know you as a person who had a motivation to do this. It's a lot of effort that a person can put into. So I'm wondering if you can tell me a little bit about yourself by telling me things like where you were born and when you were born, and how you were growing up as a young child, probably something like that.
Well, I was born in San Jose, California. 1948. And so growing up in San Jose, it's like growing up in a small community, and where my parents have always been involved in the church, and
which denomination?
The Buddhist church. Buddhist church. So we grew up in that kind of environment. So it was a, you know, very kind of supportive environment. The church is located in Japantown, San Jose, Japantown. And so we've always had a feeling of connection with community. And so when I decided to leave San Jose, but I was always involved in community work, to go to school, UCLA School of Social Welfare. That was in the early 70s. I had a chance to, when I got there, to work in, my main focus was on community organizing. And so I worked, one of the areas that I worked in as a student social worker was Cairo Nursing Home. And then my main project was in organizing or helping to organize Asian seniors. As a coalition. And so I worked on an Asian senior council. And so I worked with Filipino, Korean, Japanese, Samoan, Chinese, you know. And then whenever we met, it was like having an Asian UN, because you know, they'd all be speaking different languages.
Exactly.
And we'd have to have interpreters, and and then we'd have to work together to define what we wanted to do, and what the goals of the organization would be. And at first, I was really kind of nervous, because I thought, well, you know, a lot of these people, you know, probably remember the war, and the common enemy was Japan.
That's right, you know, absolutely.
The Chinese, the Filipino, and Korean.
Koreans, of course.
Also.
Yeah.
So I thought, oh my gosh, is this going to work? You know?
What year was it? Was it, you were born in 48, so 60s sometime?
It was actually 1971.
1971,
when I was going to school. 71 to 73. But anyway, So during that period of time, mm-hmm. we tried to do this, and I was, you know, young and naive and gung-ho, so I thought, you know, we'd be able to do this.
Yeah.
And I worked with, and I got to meet so many other people who were working mm-hmm. within those various communities, mm-hmm. but I loved working with the seniors.
Right.
And one time when you're meeting, oh, they're arguing and things like that, uh-huh. I think it's probably because of all the feelings they had because of the war. One senior citizen spoke up and he said, and he was Filipino, he says, when we, before, in the past, you know, we might have been enemies,
mm-hmm.
but we are here in America,
mm-hmm.
and we have to learn to work together,
mm.
because we have something in common.
Mm.
We are all seniors mm-hmm. here in America,
mm-hmm.
and
right.
there are certain things that we face, which is common in terms of, because of language,
mm-hmm.
sometimes we do not get the services we need.
Right.
And, you know, and we all must work together
mm.
to find some common goal.
Mm.
And after that, everybody, in the whole conference, everything, it was all translated into some different languages.
Wow.
And everybody applauded. And
it was a little delayed,
yeah.
but then everybody understood it. Yeah.
Yes. So they all understood that, yes, there's the one thing that we all have in common. We are all seniors in America,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
and all of us speak different languages,
right.
which is something that we all know that if we speak a different language,
mm-hmm.
sometimes we are not able to communicate
mm-hmm.
what we need.
Mm-hmm.
And so, therefore, we need bilingual services.
Right, right. And that's something common as well.
Yes,
yeah.
And then we also need to make sure that we have senior citizens centers
mm-hmm.
to provide services for us.
Right.
And also meals,
mm-hmm.
you know, ethnic meals.
Right, right.
You know, that we are very comfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
So there are certain things that they all felt, okay, this they can agree on.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to make sure that all the seniors, the organization was actually run by
mm-hmm.
the seniors themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were there to assist, but they themselves would come up with the goals and direction and what they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
So that worked out very well. And because of that, I got to meet all these different key leaders
mm-hmm.
within
mm-hmm.
the community and also within the senior organizations.
Right.
And so I would go to the Filipino community, senior center, the Chinese, the Korean, and, you know.
Did you take up Japanese as well?
So,
right, yeah.
So during that whole period of time, I got to work with another group of volunteers
mm-hmm.
who we decided, well, in Japan, in Little Tokyo,
mm-hmm.
There was an unserved need for seniors for meals. And serving ethnic food.
Right, yeah.
So for 5 years, we would serve meals once a month.
Mm-hmm.
We'd go shopping in the morning
mm-hmm.
to the produce market
mm-hmm.
or pick up, you know, things to make for the meal.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would prepare it that evening so that it could be served the next day.
Right, right.
And so, and we invited all those seniors that lived in Little Tokyo,
mm-hmm.
ones that lived, who were maybe alone,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
and living in the hotels or, you know, in the area.
Mm-hmm.
And people who felt probably because of their income, couldn't always have a warm meal.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So we did that for 5 years, and finally,
right.
after 5 years, it got funded.
Oh,
yeah!
Well, congratulations!
Yeah. And so now it's still going on.
Oh, I mean, it's still going
on.
In fact,
yeah, they've expanded it, and it's serving other communities too.
Mm.
Yeah. And at that time, it was during that time that they had all this resurging of Sanseis trying to find their identity, their
uh-huh.
roots.
Uh-huh.
And so,
are you Sansei as well?
Yes. Okay. And so they developed senior centers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're called pioneer centers.
Uh huh.
And these young people all worked with you know, seniors
mm-hmm.
to provide, like, say, for example, health care.
Mm-hmm.
services for the seniors, you know, transportation, all those things.
Mm-hmm.
And bilingual services, you know, social
right.
services.
Right, right.
So it was all kind of working together at that time.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of an exciting time, too, because
right.
it was all the time, too, that, you know, the larger ethnic communities were trying to find their role in changing what was available in terms of education about all the different ethnic groups.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
And so all that was kind of all working together at that time. It was
yeah.
in the 70s.
Yeah.
And so...
was there like a sort of a awareness meeting going on campus?
Well, there was awareness in terms of, you know, becoming more involved with your ethnic
right.
communities
right.
and identity.
Mm-hmm.
And the school I was going to, the UCLA School of Social Welfare,
right.
at that time recruited actually more ethnic students.
Mm-hmm.
And so the ethnic students were in the majority and the white students were in the minority.
Right.
And then that's when our school went on strike.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a possibility of the school losing its accreditation if, you know, if we continued to do the strike.
Oh, God.
And we had certain demands that we wanted the school to meet
mm-hmm.
in terms of more ethnic diversity, in terms of educational materials,
mm-hmm.
You know, practicum, you know, experience.
Mm-hmm.
So they did all that.
Mm.
You know.
So yeah. you made some important accomplishment
well,
on that front,
you know,
as well.
At that time,
no, changing the education
it was
is
a
very
period
significant.
Of time when all that was going on
right,
elsewhere too.
Right. Yeah.
And so that was part of my experience there in LA, Los Angeles.
So it must have certainly inspired you to do something more to, let's say, working with seniors. And
yeah. Well, I was, even before I went to Los Angeles for school,
mm-hmm.
I was involved in helping with a group called Asians for Community Action in San Jose.
Right, right.
And this is working with young students from the college, San Jose
uh-huh.
State,
uh-huh.
and Asian American Studies.
I
so,
see.
So they would do community service work,
mm-hmm.
and one of the areas that they were wanting to do was community organizing in the Japantown area.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so they came up with, you know, senior services and things
mm-hmm,
like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I was involved in, because I was from San Jose and because I was involved in a lot of different things, I was kind of like introducing some of the key leaders to the group Asian Community Action.
Right, right. So you were sort of a resource person to
yeah.
make connections.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that was it.
Yeah.
And I was just kind of in a supportive role. But
mm-hmm.
that was before I left.
Mm-hmm.
And so after I left, they started doing a lot of different things.
Mm-hmm.
And out of their involvement came UI Chi, which
mm-hmm.
is the Japanese American Senior Center.
Right.
Yeah. And then so when I came back from Los Angeles,
mm-hmm.
I started working with the San Jose Japanese American Citizens League,
oh,
which
yeah.
is located in Japantown,
uh-huh.
in San Jose, Japantown.
Uh-huh.
And at that time, I met the Asian law students from Santa Clara University, and they wanted to develop an information referral service.
Mm-hmm.
And because of my previous work in doing community organizing, one of the things I suggested was that they go door to door and introduce themselves,
mm-hmm.
and even though they don't have any real services to provide, just to introduce themselves and let them know that they're interested in providing services and what kinds of services that they felt
mm-hmm.
was needed in
mm-hmm.
the community.
Mm-hmm.
Because we are also very close to the Filipino senior group too.
Uh-huh.
And so that's what they did, and eventually they developed the Asian Law Alliance, which is still
right,
in existence
right.
now,
mm-hmm.
and which is very similar to Asian Law Caucus.
Mm.
So they work closely with Don Tamaki, who was involved with the Asian Law Caucus, and he
mm-hmm.
helped them to and supported them to help develop the group
mm-hmm.
Asian Law Alliance,
mm-hmm.
Similar
Asian All Alliance.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Asian
yes,
Law Alliance.
Yeah.
And then so and it's still going on. It's still there.
Yeah.
And so I got to meet the students there, and you know, got to know them. They all kind of, after they graduated, they all moved on, except for Richard Konda, who still is with the Asian Law Alliance. He's the executive director.
Really?
So, but they, you know, I said, you know, one of the things that you maybe would be very helpful is if you got involved in maybe with serving on the UICon board, or you know, maybe volunteer to do something with them, you know, so they get to know you guys, you know, and just getting more involved in the community, and then. So when I was, after I came back, because of my experience in working with the Hot Wheels program for all those years, I said, well, you know, maybe this is something that could be happening in San Jose too.
Right.
For the seniors in San Jose, Japanese seniors. So I went before the UICAI board, and they got very excited about the idea of maybe doing a kind of a pilot program, a meals program. Hot Meals program. So I got together with a group of other volunteers, and most of them were young mothers, and but they wanted to, you know, do something in the community. So
are they all Asian Americans?
They're all mostly Japanese Americans.
Oh wow! Yeah. Are they all
third generation?
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And so, so we said, well, hey, you know, let's develop a pilot Hot Meals program once a month. You know, we can serve, you know, either Wesleyan Methodist Church or the Buddhist Church.
Right.
And we go back and forth and prepare the meals, things like that. And so we did that. And out of that, you know, the mothers would get together and they provided, they said that, well, they could use childcare so that while they're volunteering with the Hot Meals program, the children would be taken care of.
Right, right.
And they would provide childcare.
They have to have that, yeah.
And it would out great. It was really great because the mothers wanted to do something. They wanted to provide a service, and they didn't have to worry about their children. The children were right next door or whatever, close by. And out of that, many of the mothers decided, well, maybe they can go back to work or go back to school or you know, do something else. And so they got their taste of doing something, working in the community.
Yeah, absolutely.
And also providing a service that was they enjoyed, providing a service to seniors.
Yeah.
So that's what happened there. And then after about a month or so, the county was, Santa Clara County was looking for to fund a Hot Meals program. And they said, well, we understand you have a pilot program going here.
Right.
We'd be interested in funding it, but it'd be on a daily basis.
Wow.
And so we said, oh my goodness, that's a change.
Is this really happening?
So, so they were able to get the funding for that.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did it pay for all the things that you wanted to do, or did it actually help you to expand?
It was paid for the, at least the Hot Meals program on a 5-day-a-week basis.
Okay.
So staff and all that. And for the cost of the meals and things. So they were able you know, to do that, and they expanded, and now they're, you know, they have their own building and things like that.
They have a demo operation.
But I know, unfortunately, because of the funding cuts and budgets, you know, they had to cut back in terms of their hours.
So is this all happening in 1970s or, well, in okay. So you are already done with your graduate work, college work at UCLA, but then you are already established in this sort of a career and community organization.
So I've always been involved in, you know, community work.
Right.
It's been something passionate of mine. And then I worked with the I went to work with the Asian Health Services in Oakland, and they provide medical services to non-English or monolingual Asians in Oakland, Alameda County. So I worked with them for a while, and then came back to and then went to San Francisco, started working for Kimochi.
Right, I'm aware of that. So do you work currently there for Kimochi?
No.
Were you married at the time, or?
Well, I got married in 1982.
Okay, so So around the time you came back to San Francisco, I think I'm really impressed and struck by how you said that, you know, when you are working on Asian seniors who share, who might have been enemies during the war, but now we are here in America, we share certain kind of things, totally very important things to share. Do you think it was important that you are America-born American in doing this kind of community work? Because you are not from Japan or you are not from Philippines, and you speak in English, that's your, I understand it's your first language, right? So you are working in this American organization, and they are all in America, right? So I find it very interesting that, you know, here you are in America, and you are working as American when you are trying to bring all kinds of different kinds of people together. But also you're working for Asians, right? So there are two interesting things going on.
Well, you know what, I've always felt that even though we have there's a certain amount of diversity, there's also some things that we have some things that you share, you know, in common. So you find the you find that those things are in common, and you work together to reach certain goals, so that everyone receives what they need. And I think once that is clearly defined, then everyone will have, you know, that goal to work together. Because in working together, you're able to accomplish much more.
Right, right.
And so I think that's one of the things that it doesn't matter even if you can speak the language or not. If everyone comes into the same agreement, and then you find other people who support that as well, then you know, then you are working towards the same goal. So that's the way I approach, you know, what we're doing with the medical examinations. Same thing. It's just different people I'm working with. It's primarily Japanese.
Right.
And but in working with you know, other Asian groups, I find that, you know, we're all here in America.
Right. Yeah.
We all have faced certain things that are, you know, difficult for us. And then having grown up with my my grandmother who lived with us, who was mostly Japanese speaking, I could understand some of the frustrations of not being able to communicate, you know, in language that's you know, different from yours. But if you try to listen and try to understand what is going on, I think with that, people feel your sincerity and feel that, and I think a certain amount of trust. So they will also work with you too, because they understand that you're not in it for yourself. You're in it so that everyone, hopefully, will gain from it. You know.
So you remember your grandparents, your grandmother very well.
She
was the first generation.
She lived with us.
Oh, she did. Okay. Was it also in San Jose?
Yes, in San Jose.
How about your parents? What did they do?
Well, my parents, they were Nisei.
Right.
So, but they always had a close connection with communicating in Japanese. And of course, being going to the Buddhist temple, you always had exposure to more, I think, more of the traditional Japanese things. And especially ministers, some of them, they only spoke Japanese, so sometimes you'd have to go to a service and they all they spoke was Japanese. So
kind
of like, oh, try to understand what they're trying to say. And I really felt that a lot of times doing that was really good, because some of the things that you say in one language is difficult to communicate.
Oh yes,
you know, into English.
You feel like you are translating it, but you are not really.
And a lot of it is, it comes by feeling and knowing. You know, it means much more. It's a much more deeper meaning than in English.
Right, right.
You can't possibly translate something that, you know, kimochi, and you know, words that, oh yeah, you get a good feeling, but not
more
exactly. Than just exactly that either, you know. And gambatte, and you know, all those things. You can't really translate it literally into English, but the feeling, there's a feeling behind it all as well. There's an emotional feeling that's attached to it. And those things you can't always pick up.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah.
But if you live or if you try to understand the culture and also the language, then mm-hmm. you can understand it, have a more deeper understanding.
Right, yeah. Right.
So because you know that whether you speak Korean or Chinese or whatever, there's some things that it's difficult to translate into
mm-hmm.
English.
Mm-hmm.
There's a feeling, a much deeper feeling to that, the meaning of that word.
Right, right.
Or phrase.
Right.
If you can appreciate it, then you can understand it. Because there's probably something that's comparable
mm-hmm.
in another language other
right.
than English.
Yeah, you might not have a right word for that
yes.
in that particular language,
yes.
but
you know
it's probably there.
Yes,
right.
It's there.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's why it was important to have the Asian seniors work together
mm-hmm.
because the one thing they do understand is that although they have different languages,
mm-hmm.
the whatever experience they have here in America, some of them are very similar in terms
mm-hmm.
of discrimination
mm-hmm.
and in terms of some of the ways that a misunderstanding,
right.
the lack of communication,
right.
all those things,
right.
you know, are very strong emotional feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And that you experience that and you know what it feels like.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think that comes from a very deep, you know, deep feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you can touch on that,
right.
then you know that, yes, we all have that in common.
Right.
We've experienced that,
mm-hmm.
definitely,
mm-hmm.
You know, because we're here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something that creates a very strong bond too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, once you realize,
right.
yes, irregardless of the war and all this kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
you know, we face so many things other than that, you know, because of we're here in America.
Do you think then this sort of your awareness as an Asian American person living in the States and living as an American citizen, but you know, wanting to work with people from different Asian backgrounds and trying to share some of the similar concerns they all experience because of, you know, commonalities,
yeah.
being senior and also being discriminated against and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think you gradually came to the awareness that, you know, you want to do something about it? Or do you think that some one event or one, individual or probably your parents change your course of thinking? In other words, I thought that, I'm wondering, you know, if you kind of...
Where that came from?
Yeah, where it came from, and then how you kind of came to town with that. Because probably at the age of 3, you weren't really thinking that way. But, you know, here you are in San Jose, you are really working actively. I just kind of wonder how it came about.
Well, you know what? When you care enough about something,
mm-hmm.
and you find other people who also care, and then you work together.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter what background you come from.
Mm-hmm.
All you know is you feel that you share this common feeling of helping others, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you work towards finding ways to work together.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
And
when did you start to think in that way?
When did I start thinking that way?
Yeah. And you know, doing all of those things are pretty remarkable. I mean, in my opinion, it is. So you can't just wake up in the morning and, you know, do. Well, probably that's the way it was for you.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what it was is you have to develop relationships.
Mm.
And once you develop relationships, you get
mm-hmm.
to know people,
mm-hmm.
and you get to know a little bit about them.
Mm-hmm.
You haven't been able to really live in their shoes,
mm-hmm.
but you know that they've maybe had some difficulties or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so, irregardless of that, they've probably overcome
mm-hmm.
many things.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you just come to appreciate people and their experiences. And I think maybe then you need to kind of develop the trust.
Mm-hmm.
And then you find things maybe you could work together on.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I don't know when that happened.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think what it is maybe it's because I'm the oldest.
You are the oldest.
And so, I have another sister.
Uh-huh.
I have a sister, younger sister.
Uh-huh.
We're only 15 months apart. And so... being the oldest, I think I was always kind of either put in a role or put myself in a role of taking care of my sister. And so, but then my mother, she was the youngest. So sometimes I found myself, you know, telling her things like, oh, Mom, you know, your mother's supposed to be able to comfort, you know, their kids. And so she would get upset at me. She's, who's the mother here? And I go, oh, you're the mother, you know. So I found myself kind of in that role. So I think that's one of the things, you know, maybe having that kind of growing up that way, I got used to kind of taking care of things or taking care of people or taking, you know, just doing that thing.
And then
doing so, you know, you have to kind of work together on things. So, you know, you always work together. And I think maybe it may come from just growing up mostly Japanese American kind of environment. So I always felt supported. I've always felt loved. And I think maybe it comes from there that you know, irregardless of whatever I do, I'm always going to be accepted and loved.
That's a great feeling to have.
But I remember one time when I went to India, we were traveling on a Buddhist pilgrimage. And so we were, you know, we were just going, you know, just we would every day we would just do our sutta chanting and one day I found that I had lost this watch and this ring. The ring had been given to me by a friend while we went, and a watch had been given to me by my parents. It was lost or got, you know, anyways, missing. And so I just felt really bad about it. I felt so bad. And so even though I was going around, you know, chanting, all I was thinking about was, golly, you know. And then all of a sudden, while I was chanting, I felt this, like, you know, a kind of wind blow. And then I heard this voice, you have lost, and yet you have gained. I know exactly what I've lost.
Yeah.
What have I gained?
Yeah, right.
What does that
mean? That'd be the question.
You know? And then I said, well, what did those things mean to me? And those things were given to me by somebody who cares for me, who loves me. And then I said, well, those are just things. But that doesn't mean that I've lost their love. And so I said, yeah, that's right.
You were thinking about it, and you were feeling bad because you care about this person.
And so with that realization, I told my friend, I said, Donna, I had this kind of insight. And then so it was a full moon. And she says, great. Well, then we should offer thanks to the Buddha. And I said, oh, yes, let's do that.
Yeah.
So we were just happened to be very close to a Buddhist kind of temple.
Where was it?
In India.
Yeah, where was it?
I can't exactly remember. It was 1970s. Anyway,
you're still young,
And so... then I said, well, let's do that. So we happened to meet this Indian family, and then they said, well, you know, you have much to be thankful for. You know, here are some candles. You know, thanks. And so we went and we offered our thanks, and then we realized that we got separated from the rest of the group. And so we saw the family again, and we told them where we were staying. We said, oh, very simple. You stay on this road, and at the end of the road is the hotel. Oh, great. So that's what we did. We went back on the road, and sure enough, at the end of the path was our hotel. And we said, oh, that's amazing. But, you know, things like that would happen to us, you know, while we were traveling throughout the country. And so all those different things, you know, people you meet, you know, you just come to realize that working together with others seems to get you so much further. Than working alone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see that.
You have a choice. Mm. Either to work alone or work with others.
It's a very different kind of project from, you know, just working on one thing just all by yourself. Mm-hmm. It's your project, but it's not
really
a collaboration.
No. Yeah. It's not really my project. Mm-hmm. It's really something that belongs to everyone. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And if people are willing to step up and take leadership, ownership of it, that's
right.
Better.
Yeah. Do you think that it's important that you're a woman? I mean, you are working on all this, and men could have done it, of course, but as it happened, you're a woman. Do you think that the fact that you're a woman mattered one way or another in all of your work?
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, you know, charm has something to do with that. I mean, you know, the ability to just kind of be friendly, and, you know, and just kind of encourage and you know, just be supportive. Mm-hmm. I think that probably has something to do with it too. Mm-hmm. But in essence, though, it has to mean something to the person you're working with.
Right.
So if you find that in common, then that's what you work with. Because then it's something bigger than yourselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm wondering though, you know, you were talking about how you became involved with the Asian American communities, and I understand this is 1970s, and that's around the time, you know, women's movement was also gaining its force, mm-hmm. and then, you know, just like Asian Americans, many of them anyway felt that they were treated in a different way in American society. There are many women who felt that way, and you were a woman, and I'm just wondering if you got in some way influenced by this, because many, you know, changes are taking place, and that's a very interesting era for that reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let's see. Well, because, you know, it was that during that time too, you know, you had like ethnic power, you know, and establishing your, you know, your identity, you know, either as a woman or within a certain ethnic group or whatever. Mm-hmm. I think all that probably had something to do with it, but also you have to be aware of the culture and how things are done, and you have to be very respectful. And I think even though you want certain things, you want to make sure that people understand that, you know, you want to be respectful. That's because I was primarily working with Asian seniors. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they're very traditional, most of them, and the role of the woman and what they and how they're supposed to behave.
Right.
That.
Right.
You don't always take on a leadership role.
Right.
But I found that within each ethnic group, the women are always very strong.
Mm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And once you establish trust and work together, especially with the women, and they confer in terms of, yes, they agree that these certain things need to be done.
Right, right.
They will help you to get it done.
Right, yeah.
So you build alliances, allegiances with those, you know, who want to work together with you to achieve those goals.
Mm-hmm.
And I think then you have that commitment.
Right, right.
So it's and I think that's how it works.
Mm.
And so I've always found that, you know, that building of relationship and trust is really key. Whether it's a man or a woman, you need to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because it has to go beyond yourselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, maybe it starts off as, oh yes, you know, I love being in the limelight. I, you know, want to take, you know, on the leadership role. I you know, love, you know, doing these kinds of things, and I love the recognition. That's part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But on a deeper level, if they understand and you understand, it goes beyond yourselves. Then I think, then it, you know, the commitment will be much longer too, and then you have an impact on their life, and they have an impact on your life because of that experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can certainly see that. I mean, Friends of Tibaksha is a great example, as far as I can see.
We're just a small organization.
Yeah, but still,
we've been able to interestingly enough, work with a lot of different folks.
Yeah,
which I appreciate.
Sure.
And a lot of them are, you know, in leadership roles too.
Mm-hmm.
When we started out, we worked with a lot of attorneys.
Attorneys,
you know,
yeah.
At first.
Yeah.
And then most of the leadership have been...
Oh, because of the law, like a medical bill, or...?
Well, because of the Committee of Atomic Bomb Survivors, they were
right.
trying to push a lot of different legislation through,
right.
Legislation.
Yeah, California
and so,
right.
but, you know, and also federal.
Mm-hmm.
But,
right.
you know, it just like, you know, it just never worked,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
because the United States did not want to assume any responsibility, and they also felt conflict,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so, the bills and everything, even after a decade, you know, never passed.
Mm-hmm.
And so, because of that, I think the legal community was very interested in what we were doing.
Right.
And then Don Tamaki, he was one of our, you know, he was the one that was with the Asian Law Alliance and also the Asian Law Caucus.
Uh-huh.
He became involved with the Asian, with our group,
mm-hmm.
FOH. And then we had... Ron Wakabayashi, who was with the, who was the executive director of the Japanese American Citizens League.
Uh-huh.
He also got involved, and Dennis Hayashi, so he was also an attorney, and now he's a judge.
Mm-hmm.
So we've had all these really interesting key people who are involved, you know, on a political level as well as, you know, just in doing community services too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are
involved.
Yeah, two yeah. different levels of things, yeah. but yeah,
yeah,
it's crucial that they work together.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Did I send you the chronology of FOH?
I have some, but I don't think I received it from you, so
oh.
I'm going to remind you.
Yeah,
so,
okay.
chronology.
Yeah. I have to update it.
Okay, that's good. So, I'm going to write it down. So, chronology of right, the name of the planning committee that we talked about earlier. And that reminds you of those things.
Mm-hmm.
There might be more, but
yeah. yeah.
So tell me a little bit about what it means to you to work on survivors with Japanese background. So I understand, based on what you all told me so far, so you are very engaged with working with people, with group of people, and you are very much of a specialist in working with senior people.
Mm-hmm.
And I see how those things can be brought together in your work for Friends of Hibakusha. But, you know, like you said, OCAPS had a really, in a way, unsuccessful effort to obtain federal government
mm-hmm.
compensations for
mm-hmm.
American Hibakushas.
Mm-hmm.
And you could say it's a very difficult time.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a feeling that people got really disappointed
yeah.
with
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
Do you think of this as a sort of a unique project? Because, you know, it's in a way unique because there aren't many American survivors and the American government doesn't want to really pay for them.
Mm-hmm.
How do you see that sort of aspect of that engagement? I guess that's what I'm asking.
Well, you know, one of the things that I know is that although the American government does not want to take or assume any responsibility, the Japanese government has.
Mm-hmm.
At least the Hiroshima Perpetual Medical Association
mm-hmm.
first, and then they took on that challenge and commitment to serve the overseas,
mm-hmm.
you know, Hibakusha.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually the government, the Japanese government, began to play a more defined role.
Right.
But, and I think their commitment is as long as there's Hibakusha in the world,
mm-hmm.
they'll continue, you know, to serve them.
Mm-hmm.
And so with that in mind, I always feel very appreciative,
mm-hmm.
you know, because with what's going on now within Japan, I mean, to continue that commitment is,
mm-hmm.
you know, is pretty remarkable.
Right, right,
yeah.
absolutely.
But at the same time, because of what's happening with Fukushima and, you know,
mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot we can learn
mm-hmm.
from what's happened. And, of course, what happened in Chernobyl,
mm-hmm.
you know. I understand that they had asked the Japanese Radiation and Research Effects Foundation to kind of help and kind of share, you know, what's going on, with the possibility of a radiation exposure over a period of time.
Right.
And I think that's probably going to be ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's going to be a lot to learn about, in terms of alternative energy use and conservation out of this experience coming out from Japan.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, that's going on now.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot we can learn from this whole thing, too. I really feel that that's what it is. It's more of a exchange of ideas and learning from the experience.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully enlightening others in terms of for the future.
Yeah, I certainly agree with you. But I guess what I'm kind of trying to ask you about is how you see the lack of American government support for the kind of work that you do, despite the fact that you're American and working for, people who are American citizens and living in America.
Mm-hmm.
And one can, outsider might look at it and say that, wow, this is a really challenging place to be. I just wonder if you think about it at all, or if it's not a conflict, it's not a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But I just wonder how you yourself see that.
Mm-hmm. Well, the one thing that's historical, and the whole world knows, is the United States was the first one to drop the atomic bomb.
Mm-hmm.
History does not change.
Right.
And the fact that once everyone, the United States has also, thanks to Obama, has also come to acknowledge that and the role that they played in actually opening the Pandora's box to other countries beginning to use the atomic weapons.
Absolutely, yeah.
I think since then, and because of maybe the experience, there has not been another bomb that has been dropped on other
civilians. Right.
Yeah. And I think that's something that maybe, hopefully, will continue to be.
Mm-hmm.
Because right now, what we have in the arsenal is so much more powerful than the atomic bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima
exactly.
and Nagasaki.
Right, right.
We could destroy the world.
Right, more than one time.
Yes, yes. And so I think with that kind of legacy, hopefully, people will still continue to maybe think about it before they do something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I know that Japan is very nervous about North Korea, and of course there's Iran, but at the same time, I think people are much more aware that this is something that can destroy all of us, not just one country.
Right. Right.
And at the same time, I feel that the younger generation too, hopefully, will look at the fact that we don't always have to enter a war in order to exchange ideas or political differences. We can actually maybe hopefully doing it in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it is frustrating that the hibakusha. Well, actually, there's over a million called hibakusha. And that includes those service, those military personnel who are exposed in terms of the tests.
Right, right.
The uranium miners, the people who are exposed, like in the Marshall Islands, things like that.
Absolutely.
So there's more than just the hibakusha.
Right, right.
And of course, the hibakusha in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And also live in South America and also in Korea.
Right.
So there's more than just the American hibakusha.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's why the commitment is for the Japanese that they will go and serve the certain hibakusha wherever they are.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you have to go with what you have right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so we just work with what we have right now.
Sure.
Because otherwise, the frustration of trying to get, everyone's trying to get something.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, all the governments are actually in a bind in terms of money.
Right.
And so I think that's how I probably would answer that.
Yeah.
You work with what you have right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what we have is, we're so fortunate to have.
Mm.
I mean, I was amazed that the Japanese government is still committed to providing, you know, these kinds of services.
Right, yeah. In a way, like you said, given the, you know, economy right now,
yeah.
It's amazing that they're doing it. But again, correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that Japanese government really needed to take a long time before they started to pay compensation for hibakushas overseas. My understanding is that, you know, for Koreans living in Japan, there was a compensation a long time ago,
yeah.
But Koreans living in Korea,
yeah.
That was another matter. And the same thing applies to American hibakushas,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's relatively recent,
yeah.
Yeah, that Japanese government actually started to pay, and even the medical checkup were supported
mm-hmm.
by the medical association
mm-hmm.
rather than the Japanese
right.
government.
Right. So even though it takes a long time,
mm-hmm.
eventually something will happen.
Mm.
And so thanks to the commitment
mm-hmm.
of the Hiroshima Professional Medical Association
mm-hmm.
and to, you know, it, that's what it takes.
Mm-hmm.
It takes sometimes forever
mm-hmm.
getting the thing done.
Yeah.
But the commitment was there.
Right, right.
And so over time, people see that commitment
mm-hmm.
and they see the need.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you can stick with it,
right,
eventually
right.
something will happen.
So it's important to stick with
it's
and continue. Keep on going.
Keep on going.
Just like you got funding for
yeah.
community works
yeah.
that you did. First it was without
yeah.
you know, funding,
exactly.
but later on
yeah.
there was a support.
And what keeps you going is you know that it's important.
Mm-hmm.
And you're committed to doing it.
Right.
And finding others who also share that same commitment.
Mm-hmm.
And then you continue to do it.
Right. Do you think things will be different? They will change in the future? Let's say American government attitude toward hibakushas or nuclear weapons in general, either way.
I think that, especially the weapons, I think that's beginning to change.
Right, right.
And I think because of, there's also, you know, a lot of conflict in the world right now.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it has to do with, things are changing very rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what we need to do is support those changes that, you know, support the people who are in need.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, begin to understand that maybe we need to look at things a little bit differently
mm-hmm.
because the world is changing.
Right, right.
And on top of that, the environment is changing.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to affect everyone.
Right, right.
You know, not just immediately your country or whatever.
Yeah.
But the world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What are we going to do if we run out of water? Fresh water?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what are we going to do when the weather changes
mm-hmm.
or the climate changes
mm-hmm.
and then also the temperature of the waters change.
Right, right, yeah.
Fresh water becomes salt water.
Yeah, you can't be just thinking about your national
no.
interest anymore.
No,
right,
can't.
Yeah.
And I think that's what we have to do. We have to take a more worldly view.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things that changes the world is because of the internet and because of, you know, just the way things are communicated, you
mm-hmm.
know, Facebook and this
right.
whole chain, you know, social
yeah,
network, right?
Right, right.
And I think maybe in some ways the world is becoming closer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah.
And so I think young people want to communicate in that way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, they can't wait to communicate. They want to communicate now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think, and that's even, well, to me, the key would be actually to travel.
Mm.
I would always encourage people to travel.
Right, yeah.
Know, because that always will probably change your perspective.
Mm-hmm.
At least make you maybe look at the larger picture.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe appreciate
yeah.
those things that you've really taken for granted.
Right, right.
Yeah,
absolutely,
because
yeah.
when I see, you know, like people in the poorer countries, they love going to school, you know, but it's so expensive for them, or they, you know, because of the hardship of maybe their nation is at war or something and they can't go. I said, look at here in America. You know, we're struggling actually to keep schools open
mm-hmm,
and keeping
mm-hmm.
the teachers.
Mm-hmm.
But do people really appreciate education?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
As much as these other poor
right,
countries.
Right, yeah.
Really
that's
do.
The irony.
They
yeah.
walk for miles
right,
to go to school.
To go to school. Yeah.
And I said, people have gone to see a bigger picture,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
And especially, I think, here in America.
Mm-hmm.
I think we people are very ignorant about many things, and I think especially of other cultures, and you know, if we can appreciate other cultures and maybe have a better understanding, then we can maybe understand why certain things like wailing and all those things, and you know, it's part of the culture.
Yeah.
But if you don't understand it,
right,
then you look at it in a different way.
Right, yeah.
But if you understand it, then you perhaps you won't take an attack mode, but also maybe a better understanding.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't mean that you stop criticizing what you've been criticizing, but it would be at least based on, you know, based on a better understanding of what the other party is doing, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I think that's a good way of describing
it. And you can't take away somebody's livelihood.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what are you going to replace it with?
Right, yeah. Right. So do you have an answer for that?
Yeah.
I mean, if you have an answer for that, then we can come.
Then,
Right, exactly.
Absolutely.
And I think, see your point of view.
Because you have to look at it that way, too. If someone were to take away your livelihood, of course you're going to be upset. And you don't want that to happen. But what else? Would you have an alternative? Do you have something else for them to do? In this economy now,
You know, speaking of, I like what you said about, you know, you encourage young people to travel and get a different perspective on things, because otherwise you would think your way is a mainstream and you will never have this real sense of diversity.
You know,
I really think, is that true?
In Buddhism, you know, you always look at, there's so many ways to look at one thing. So many different eyes to see
a
problem.
Yeah, I know what you mean, right?
Finding a way to solve it.
That's connected.
And so, you know, that's what I always think. You know, that's why you need to have more than one person looking at something.
Right, yeah, I see that,
You have different, you know, different points of view,
and
then you maybe come up with a different conclusion.
Right, right.
You know?
Yeah, and even your goal might be redefined as well based on that. Now, I'm trying to make that point of view somehow related to what actually happens in the medical checkup and effort, as an effort that Friends of Vipaksha makes. I noticed that, you know, there used to be more Korean Americans coming to medical checks up, and I think there was only one person this year. How do you see, is this just a matter of people just winding down in their number because they're getting old and some people are dying?
I think that has a lot to do with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I've been noticing the past two medical visits, people are becoming more frail and people are passing away and are becoming more ill.
Right. How about Korean-American participation, though?
And Korean-American, I'm not sure, because I haven't really been really in touch with that aspect of it. But I've noticed, like, Mr. Huang, who comes to Sacramento.
Right.
You know, he was educated
In Japan. Yeah, or in Japanese.
Yeah.
So
he has a kind of a different perspective.
Right.
In that sense.
Right.
And I really like Mr. Huang.
Yeah, he's a very nice gentleman.
And I can see why, you know, he was put into the positions he was because of the way he is. Great integrity. But I really don't know in terms of why there might be fewer. But there are fewer overall coming.
Yeah. Do you remember any other Korean Americans who used to come?
I don't. I don't remember. But Mr. Wong was one of the few, and I was so glad that he, you know, he did come.
Right.
And I'm not sure in terms of when they go to Korea or the Koreans that they serve in Japan, how many there are either. I don't know. But I think that's why HiCare is so important.
Right.
HiCare is a program that, you know, that, that they talked about during the presentation. And they came up with a lot of different things, you know, information.
So mean.
Oh my God.
My treat.
Thank you.
It's my pleasure to do that.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so, so I think that's probably something that would be good to get back to Dr. Yanagida.
Uh-huh.
Dr. Yanagida is very involved with the high care program, mm-hmm. and is also involved with, with the International Physicians for Social Responsibility or whatever.
Right,
that is.
Right, IPP, yeah, yeah.
Something or other.
Okay.
Yeah.
And, he also mentioned he went to North Korea twice.
Yeah. See? So I think it'd be good to talk to him about that.
Okay. Yeah.
He has probably a different perspective too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Dr. Usui, I really enjoyed him. He's he has a PhD besides an MD. And so he's really into the academics.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Mm. He's written books and things like that, too.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So was he one of the physicians who came from
He
Japan?
Actually was the general overall
okay.
team coordinator
okay. yeah.
for both. But he actually, this time he came here to San Francisco 2 years ago.
Uh-huh.
But this time he went to Honolulu and
I see. So of course I didn't have a chance to meet with him.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
But it would be good. Dr. Yanagida works with Dr. Usui.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see.
They came and did a high care presentation 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
In St. Mary's. In fact, I think Dr. Umekubo.
Yeah.
He was able to do a recorded that whole thing presentation. I think he has it on DVD.
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
So if you have a chance to talk to Dr. Umekubo,
uh-huh.
are you going to be interviewing him too?
No, I try to make arrangement, but somehow there was a miscommunication.
Yeah.
So
yeah. And he's going to be actually leaving on his trip this weekend.
Oh,
so
really?
That's why
so
he,
probably doesn't work
this,
out. Yeah.
This didn't work out for him either. So. Yeah.
Mm. Okay. Yeah, I will try to look into that.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Now, I noticed that there are hibakushas who are living in the States who want to get hibakusha techo, the proof that they are hibakushas, try to apply for it, couldn't get it for various reasons. It's not easy thing to do.
Yeah.
And they get frustrated. So that's one sort of a group of people who really want to get hibakusha techo. And then there are other people who really are not interested in getting hibakusha techo at all.
Mm-hmm.
Like they might have a health problem, but they are not really interested in it for whatever reasons.
Yeah.
Do you have any perspective on that? I mean, what makes a difference?
What makes a difference? I don't know. I think that's something you have to ask them.
Yeah.
Because I really don't know why they choose to try to have it or not to have it.
Mm-hmm.
It may have to do with their background and their perspective in terms mm-hmm. of whether or not they want to be identified as mm-hmm. Hibakusha, or whether or not they feel that at their age it doesn't really matter now
mm-hmm.
because they're getting the medical. Health services that they need,
right.
or they're working with their physicians who already know that they're survivors,
mm-hmm.
and they don't have to worry about insurance because
right.
they, won't be taken away from them,
mm-hmm.
especially if they have Medicare
mm-hmm.
or even Medi-Cal,
right?
And then, or some of them prefer that they can take care of themselves, or they'll go to Japan if they need medical services because
mm-hmm.
that would be free for them.
Mm-hmm.
And even if they don't have a techo, I think there's probably some information that shows that they are survivors.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And at least applying for it is I think a good idea if you want to.
Mm-hmm.
And but I which is the reason why they have the two people that did you have a chance to talk to them?
No, but
they were interviewing first-time survivors or first-time people, and also providing information to those people who wanted information about.
Okay. At the station. Mm-hmm.
The interviewers or counselors. So they were part of the team, and they're always part of the team. There's always two people.
Yeah, that's great. That's a wonderful idea.
Will give you that information.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then they will also, if you want to apply, you probably could, or
mm-hmm.
maybe they could tell you that, it's going to be difficult or something. But at least, you have somebody there who can mm-hmm. answer you
right,
in terms of
right.
What they can do for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah,
and because I know there's certain people, yes, who don't want to have a tetra or choose not to.
Right.
And
yeah.
I was like, why? You know, maybe be good.
Yeah.
And if you have a tetra, you know, maybe your children, you know, can receive services and things like that.
Right. Right.
But I don't know. I don't know unless you to ask them personally.
Yeah, yeah. Sure, I will do that.
It's a personal thing.
Yeah, it is. I know. Yeah. But I'm really curious to know because obviously that really carries a lot of weight.
And you know, I think to follow up on that, you might talk to those two. Did you get their card? Mr. Kuna? I'll see if I can get the cards.
Okay.
And you might be able to email them.
Okay.
And ask them those questions. You know,
right.
In their findings, you know, what have they found, and you know, something in terms of.
What are their names? I would just try to.
I think it's Mr. Kono and.
Okay.
They're on that list. And
the planning?
The city.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
The medical team list.
Yeah, okay.
And you have that. And they're from the Hiroshima, Nagasaki.
So from Japanese side?
City, yeah.
Right, okay.
They're the ones that did the counseling. You know, I have a 3:30 appointment.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
Nagasaki.
Oh yeah, it's always nice to have their letters and their names spelled out in kanji letters. It really helps me to remember. All right, I won't write it down right now, but I will probably ask
but
you later.
They would be good, I think, to ask in terms of the general,
right?
What they found.
Right, right, yeah. So they are actually talking to people who wanted to apply for the techo. Right. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Oh, even in Japan, too.
Sure, okay. So they do that in Japan as well?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I don't know if these two do, but at least
they
might
probably
know.
Have some ideas.
Yeah.
Right, yeah, that's a good point. I will definitely follow up.
Just to get a bigger perspective.
Mm-hmm. Let me just put it away.
Okay. Yeah.
So I guess I know you have to go. I don't know what time it is now.
Put the rooms. Did you sign one already?
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
But I guess one of my last few questions is about how you see the change in leadership or really the change over time in general. So you've been involved in this for a long time by now, and I know that there was a leadership change in the CAPS. So for instance, from Kuramoto to Mr. Kuramoto to Endo, mm-hmm. right? And then now Mariko is going to be taking it over. Do you think, I mean, with or without relationship to the change in the leadership, do you think that the approach changed over time?
I think so. Well, you know, Kanji, he's more of the
Thank you.
Kind of face of CAPS.
Mm-hmm.
So he was always much more visible.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Endo is not as visible.
Mm.
You know, he kind of works behind the scenes.
Really?
And isn't quite as visible. Kanji was more visible in terms of media and
uh-huh.
Accessible that way.
Uh-huh.
Whereas Mr. Endo is a little bit more private.
Mm-hmm.
And then Mariko's kind of in between, but she's also the youngest.
Mm,
so
that's true.
There's a different perspective because she's in utero, so she's not really like experienced in terms of the atomic class
right.
or anything like that.
Yeah.
So there's kind of a difference in that. you know. And Mr. Andrew's a little more on the private side. But of course, once you get to talk to him, one to one, he's very, but you know, in kind of like media and all that kind of thing, he prefers not to have a public.
Why do you think that's the case? Is this just a personality, or
I think it's personality? Yeah. It's his personality.
But you mentioned how because Lindsay, Mariko Lindsay is a different generation, that might explain the difference in style. Mm-hmm. Do you think that matters?
Yeah, and also, you know, just the personality, and also I think. Mr. Endo, there's a difference in personality, how they do things. Because on a one-on-one, Mr. Endo's fine. But, you know, sometimes, so, he gets easily upset sometimes. And that's kind of visible. So that may not be always the best thing. But I always have to take into consideration the intent of the person. They always mean well, but it may not come across that way,
right? Yeah,
because
sure.
of the way they are, and they get easily either irritated or upset, or you know, and maybe because of age, that might be happening more. So I was kind of. And then Mariko, of course, being younger, you know, they'll always. And plus, you know, she's been doing a lot of different things. She has much, you know, she helps teach Japanese, and she's,
you know,
she's been involved in the kind of sister city kind of things. With her community and their sister cities. So, you know, it's a little different. It's a little different. And she enjoys, you know, doing different things, traveling and symphony and all those things, you know. So it's a little different. And plus, I think...
Do you mean more precisely, she has lots of other things going on, so she might not be the bartender?
Yeah.
I understand.
And maybe that not that rigid sometimes, you know. But it depends too on what it is that she's involved in. I know this time she was felt like she was under a lot of pressure because she's never done it before. That's why she felt more comfortable making sure that, you know, Kay and I were going to be there, and you know, and even though I told her, well, it'll be okay. You have to be there, you know.
Okay.
It makes you feel better. Yes, okay. Of course. But she says, well, now that I've done it, I kind of know what to do next. And I know
good.
What to expect. And I've met all these people. I know who they are.
Right. Yeah. That's
so
good.
So next time, I feel more confident. I said, good.
Yeah. So you had a sort of a debriefing time with decompressing time with her. That's good. I think
we'll meet again. Yeah.
Yeah.
For lunch or something.
Yeah. I definitely like to keep in touch with her because she really looks like an interesting person.
Yeah.
But I think you're right to say that she was under a lot of pressure, especially because it was the first time.
But, you know, so was the medical team members, too.
Right, exactly.
Because this is their first time also.
Right. So are you happy with the result or the way the exam went today?
You know, I think so, because, you know, you always have kind of little glitches, you know, like, oh, you know, we need more of this or that, or we need, you know, something that changes or whatever. But you know, you just kind of, if you've been doing it long enough, you just kind of, okay, go with the flow of things, you know, and you just adjust. And then, and I think having Barry there was kind of different because Barry has never been really involved in coming to the medical exam. And this time he had exposure to what we do.
Barry
Lawler.
Oh,
he's
okay.
The medical director.
Right.
Of the medical services.
Right.
And,
okay.
So he was there, which made it a little different. And of course, Dr. Umekubo. He's a supervising physician, so he's always around. So that really helped a lot, too.
Why do you think Larry decided to come at this time?
Because last time he was on vacation.
Oh, so he couldn't make it. Okay.
Yeah. And this time I guess he had the time to do it.
Okay, well, that's a good thing. Well, I hope St. Mary will be able to support this effort.
I hope so too. I know medical services and hospitals are having a tough go.
Right. I think it's true to many places.
Yes. So hopefully, you know, I mean, their commitment is there, but you know.
Yeah, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's capable of doing whatever, everything that they want to do. Yeah. So I really do hope that, you know, it continues and different locations as well. Anything that you remains to be said? I mean, when we talk in this way, there will be probably things that you thought that I would ask you, but then I didn't, and then you thought that I was going to say that, but then I didn't have a chance to say this.
Well, probably I'll think about it, and then I'll let you know.
Okay, sure. Yeah, I'll keep in touch. So whatever comes to your mind, I'll let you know. So, well, thank you very much for your time.
Thank
it
you.
Was very useful. Yeah. I really appreciate that you made this
for
opportunity.
Lunch too,
sure. Yeah, my pleasure.
Yeah. I have to go to the hospital because I'm going to be.